Our first reading this morning comes from the prophet Isaiah, the second chapter, the first five verses. The word that Isaiah, son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it. Many peoples shall come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths." For out of Zion shall go forth instruction and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and shall arbitrate for many peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. O house of Jacob, come. Let us walk in the light of the Lord.
From the Gospel of Matthew. But about that day and hour no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. For as the days of Noah were, so it will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day of Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing until the flood came and swept them all away, so too will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then two will be in the field, one will be taken and one will be left. Two women will be grinding meal together, one will be taken and one will be left. Keep awake, therefore, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But understand this: if the owner of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. The word of the Lord. Many of you know that our family enjoys having a cottage in western North Carolina, just east of Asheville, in an area known as the front porch of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Because we have lived in three different cities, moving from one church to another, our mountain home has been the constant, and in many ways it serves as our family's center of gravity. We love those mountains, as many of you have a familiar, favorite destination, a place where you might go every summer or for the holidays, another mountain retreat or camp, or home at the shore, which might serve as your family's spot, as the Blue Ridge Mountains have become for us. One of the things I enjoy most there is the sense of being in the wild, closer to nature, with large scenic views all around. We love to swap stories of black bear sightings with our neighbors, hike to mountaintop vistas, and drive past gorgeous scenic views on the parkway and other lesser-known winding roads. However, there is one of those off-the-beaten-path overlooks that I enjoy, not so much for the view, but rather for the comic, even ironic, nature of it. When driving up a steep incline, you see one of those familiar roadside markers that says, "Scenic View." The road widens to allow the leisurely traveler to slow down or to pull over for a longer look. But what is amusing about this particular scenic overlook is that there is no view. You cannot see anything for a thick wood. Obviously, about the time the little stone wall was built there and a picnic table placed in the clearing at the upper edge of that valley which disappears into the mountains, some seeds took root. Now big, old hardwoods and evergreens have grown up just beyond that little wall, completely blocking any view. What may have once been a stunning scenic overlook is now absolutely invisible because of what took root there and grew up to obscure a distant beauty. When we arrive at the season of Advent each year, we have these stunningly beautiful mountaintop views from the prophet Isaiah. These are hopeful, comforting words that envision the coming of God. But through the years, they have become harder and harder to see. The view to which Isaiah draws our attention is a scene of nations streaming to the mountain of the Lord for worship, people living under God's rule in harmony with one another, and the instruments of war being reshaped into farming tools. Oh, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord is the prophet's culminating summons to all the earth. The problem is that about the time that scenic overlook was envisioned as a place to stop and look ahead to be rejuvenated for the journey of faith, some seeds began to take root. Wars and rumors of wars have sunk deep roots in the world, and it is hard to see the peace beyond them. So many scenic overlooks have literally been obscured by a polluted haze or wildfires brought on by a seemingly endless drought. Human beings, which Isaiah proclaimed would harmonize their walking together in God's pathway, seem to have met a huge fork in the road and gone in very different directions. Over long years, that ancient invitation, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord, seems to have morphed into something more akin to the whole human family groping in the darkness. Even the gospel writer Matthew, who knew Isaiah's prophecy quite well, wrote about the future of God's reign as if he had a hard time hanging on to that glorious scenic view. For Matthew's description of the coming of God takes on a foreboding hue with the apocalyptic overtones of judgment casting shadows across the prophet's future of global peace and harmony. Matthew likens the advent of God's coming to the days of Noah, when most of the world was washed away, as well as a coming terrible judgment day or a thief breaking into at night. With this hyperbolic, exaggerated speech, Matthew warns that we do not know when the Lord is coming. So be alert, be watchful for God, who will come at the unexpected hour. Matthew's version reminds me of what the theologian Jack Boozer of Emory University once said about the season of Advent. In this strange season, when we are suspended between realization and expectation, may we be found honest about the darkness and thereby more perceptive of the light. The gospel, I believe, is being honest about the darkness in order to help us perceive the light. Did you know that the average number of stars visible from a city suburb in the United States on a clear night is about 250? But the average number of stars visible from the wilderness is 2,500. Sometimes, in the darkest of circumstances, we can see light that we would not have seen without the darkness. The life God intends for the world has not yet come. The harmony God imagines for the human family is far from being realized. The peace God promises is at best a distant dream. And yet that life and harmony and peace nonetheless illumine our pathway to walk in the light of the Lord. Episcopal priest Martha Stern writes of going to a planetarium with her husband one early December for a special program on the Christmas star. She says that there was not a big crowd out that cold night, but the ones who straggled in seemed to suggest a more rambunctious audience than she would have preferred. There was a couple with a baby who seemed quite awake and whiny, which is not a good sign in a theater about to go dark. There was an older gentleman who would not stop talking about the planetarium's recent renovation in a very loud voice. And when they were settled into their seats, in came a whole crowd of teenage boys, obviously dragged there by some adult, wearing their baggy pants and t-shirts with ornery slogans on them, and as she put it, tennis shoes as big as Rhode Island. With the baby and the loud gentleman and the teenagers, the mood was foreboding for this little program about the Christmas star, and it appeared it would be anything but all is calm, all is bright. But then the lights began to dim, all the way to pitch black dark. For a moment there, in that deep velvet dark, it felt like a land of deep darkness, and Martha found herself feeling strangely afraid. And then very, very slowly, above and all around, the stars began to glimmer. The planets began to glow, and very distant suns beamed. She writes, "The heavens enveloped us, moving in some kind of stately circle dance all over and around us as if to reveal God's glory. And in that small space, with that unpromising and motley crowd all around, the faces were transformed. The sullen teenager four seats down had thrown his head back in wonder. And the little baby let out not a cry, but a sigh of great pleasure. At the end, she thought the show was great. Good science, good theology, very interesting. But the best view of all, the best view of all, came in seeing that odd and incompatible crowd together, lost in joy and wonder." Friends, even when Isaiah's vision of the glorious advent of God seems obscured, by all manner of terrible things that block its view, from the morning news, the endless wars, the earthquakes and tsunamis, the floods and wildfires, the concern about the earth itself being on the brink, to the great chasms that divide the human family one from another, we have this hope that God will come again and a new day will dawn when people will live in harmony with one another and in peace with the one who created us all for goodness. At the end of one of his books about the history of human civilization, Thomas Cahill turns toward the future with an honest and clear eye, saying, "As we look across our earth, we see many signs of despair, poverty, hunger, a population explosion of enormous proportions that we Westerners insist on ignoring." And then the historian begins to sound like a biblical prophet when he observes, "We also see signs of hope. What will be lost and what will be saved for our civilization probably lies beyond our power to decide. The future may be germinating today, not in a boardroom in London or an office in Washington, or in a bank in Tokyo, but in some bizarre outpost or another, a kindly British orphanage in the grim foothills of Peru, a house for the dying in the back streets of Calcutta, run by a fiercely single-minded nun, an easygoing French medical team at the starving edge of the Sahel between the African Sahara and Sudan, a mission to Somalia by Irish social workers who remember their own great hunger, a nursery program to assist convicted mothers at a New York prison. The future may be germinating in some unheralded corner where a great-hearted human being is committed to loving outcast in an extraordinary way. With hope like that, which is the hope the Bible pictures for us from the prophet Isaiah to the life and ministry of Jesus Christ, we too can look beyond the things that seem to have grown up to obscure the view God wants us to see. Since God is coming at the unexpected hour, let us be ready, therefore, to slow down and pull over and take in the vast and glorious long-range scenic view. Because the mountaintop vision of nations walking in the light of the Lord helps us to be great-hearted human beings, loving in extraordinary ways, until we ourselves become part of the hope. Amen.